Welcome back, everybody. This is Operators episode number 54 coming at you. This week, we are going to be talking about outsourcing and AI and what's the future of college education and how is technology disrupting everything going to change the way that businesses operate. Glad that you're with us.
We've been doing so much international expansion lately. I was just getting some, you know, we just actually launched our Mother's Day sale, and someone was hitting me up about Canada, how Canada is crushing. And we just had so much going on. We had a new apron drop. We had our Mother's Day sale. We've got sales in all these different countries going on around Mother's Day. And we're just looking at how Fulfill just crushed it for us. And I was just thinking about when you expand overseas brands, you need to make sure that you're able to handle, you know, the logistics, inventory, being able to introduce new channels, integrations, 3PLs, like being able to send new orders quickly, whether they're expanding to new territories in the States or outside new channels. I mean, it's amazing how easily we've been able to stand up new stuff in our business. And our business is big now. Fulfill has been so easy to integrate with the EDI, you know, visibility into everything, visibility into our orders, our warehouse management. I have people asking about NetSuite for WMS in some of our chats. And I'm just like, what are you thinking? Like, do you really want to go deeper down the NetSuite rabbit hole? So kudos to Fulfill. That said, I need to go to them and I need to get some more users and I want a good deal. I want to say it was so nice seeing Matt in person a few weeks ago when he came to LA. I've had the pleasure of spending a lot of time with Sean and Mike, some good time with Mike. We got to get together in person more often. We're going to have like an operators retreat. Like we don't even like really necessarily do too much. Like we don't have to get a bunch of people there, but just like hanging in person and doing something. Like the all-in guys play poker. What's our poker? We got to come up with something.
According to Sean, it's e-commerce. That's what
yeah,
we do.
Yeah, we'll all get together and set up Facebook campaigns together. That's Sean's love language.
We'll all go Google with Sean.
Well, so it's funny you say this, Jason, because I have still never been in the same room as Matt. To my understanding, it's never happened, which is kind of like a thing we're gonna talk about today, is like how the world's changing and business is changing. But it's still funny to me that Matt and I, for all the talking we've done, for all the texting, we've still never been in the same place physically.
You almost don't need to see Matt in person because he's so prolific.
This is it. I'm actually a robot. I'm Elon's Optimus. With a meat suit.
I'm going to cling to the idea that Matt is just an AI, you know, video.
Mike tweeted out this thing. I'm going to read it. And I'd love to, let's just start with the tweet. So Mike, it's brilliant. American workers advocate strongly for remote work, but it undermines their key competitive advantage compared to international workers. Over time, I think most American workers will push for in-person work environments to protect jobs from outsourcing. So, Mike, I want to start with you. What is this key competitive advantage? Why did you tweet this? And then maybe like Jason and Sean, I'll get you guys to weigh into. But where did this come from? Because this hit home for me.
Yeah. So, I mean, the dynamic that I see on Twitter is so much of, hey, you know, remote work is awesome. Companies that are in person are these dinosaurs. You know, this is so great. And obviously during COVID, this just, you know, really accelerated the number of companies that are fully remote or partially remote. And I guess I would start here by saying, like, you know, I get it. I get why, from an American worker's perspective, like, this is awesome. Like, more flexibility, more freedom, you know, casual Fridays where I'm just kind of hanging out at home. But the observation I was trying to make is nobody is thinking this thing through 5, 10, 20 years down the future, which is the moment that you give up your key competitive advantage, which is your physical location, then it's a total meritocracy. And, or I would say it's a meritocracy where pay really matters. And the world is full of very, very smart, very driven people that are willing to work for a lot less than Americans, because just their cost of living surrounding them is a lot less. And so, like, if I'm running a company where I've got an office and I expect people to be in the office, then basically my hiring pool is people that live within whatever X number of miles of my company headquarters, or people who are willing to move there for that job. And historically, that's just been the way that work happened, that you, when you wanted to hire somebody, you hired somebody close. And then occasionally, maybe if it was like a C-level position, you'd go and you'd do a bigger search where you would try and attract somebody in. If you're in a market like I am, like Oklahoma, not a lot of people are like ready to move to Oklahoma. So you're pretty much hiring, you know, kind of around yourself. But with the move that we've made towards remote work, obviously this is kind of an inflection point where companies are all of a sudden, like Google announced this last week that they're letting go of a bunch of engineers and sending it overseas. I think one thing that American workers have not caught up to is just how much cheaper labor is compared to them around the world and how quickly that labor is catching up. There are definitely some areas where American labor is more skilled and has some competitive advantages on the skill side, but technology is rapidly reducing those. And so from my point of view, there's going to be a little bit of a reckoning that happens at some point in the next 5 or 10 years where American workers are like, crap, we opened Pandora's box. We should have tried to be pushing for in-person where they are hiring American workers and not where my job can just say, hey, why am I paying you $60,000 when I can pay $10,000 for somebody in Colombia that's just as driven and just as skilled as you are? And so anyway, like right now, it's really popular to like seek out positions that are work remote. But with the advances of AI and technology and the dispersion of information, I don't think American workers realize quite what they've brought on themselves. Another guy that we're all friends with, very smart, e-com operator, DM'd me directly after I sent that and said, I think this is going to be the number one thing that happens. I think wages in the US are going to be under significant downward pressure. I'm just trying to figure out how to play it. So there's other smart people who are really thinking about this. But yeah, it was just kind of an observation that it was funny. I'd never seen anybody make that, like, you know, when you're a worker, you have a set of skills and a set of qualities that make you a good candidate. And the fact that people don't think about the fact that geography is a big one of those skills is really funny to me.
Thomas Friedman wrote a book. He's a New York Times columnist, by the way, not a fan of the New York Times, going to say it, but I used to really like Thomas Friedman a lot. I read a bunch of his books. He was pretty smart. I think he's been hijacked somehow. His brain's been hijacked. But he wrote a book called The World is Flat. And this is just the continuation of what's been going on since manufacturing got outsourced from the US, that you can move things so quickly. And then you could now it's just evolved into quick communication. Without the communication, right, without Zoom and Slack and everything else, we wouldn't be able to do this. This is just the evolution. It's just happening. And what you're pointing out is that if you're a young person, you need to protect yourself from being made obsolete. Like, that is your job. You really have to do that. And there are a lot of people who don't get it. And what they're doing is, oh, I want to be a contractor. I want to live my life. I want to work on my terms. And that might work pretty well for a while. And, you know, you got a lot of guys that are good meta people, right? And they'll collect 4 clients at $5,000 a month. They'll make $20,000 a month. They're 28 years old. That's pretty good money. And like, we could talk about the education piece too later, but like you don't even need to be like super, you don't have to go to a fancy school or any of that. Like, but if you really want to be a player, you need to be where the decision makers are more frequently, as much as possible. Like Connor, our head of growth, is in Denver. I wish he was in LA. It would be better for the company and better for him if he was in LA. He does come to LA from time to time. I'm going to Denver tonight to go hang out with the growth team. We're doing like a growth team retreat in Denver. But you got to be where the decision makers are, because otherwise, like, you're just another number, and you can still be just another number, but you're really like increasing the odds of being another number if you're just a remote person. And obviously Ridge has done a really great job cultivating a remote culture, but Ridge also has lots of offshore people. And I am, you know, as one of the leaders of Hexclad, I am pushing my team like crazy to make hires outside the United States, because I just think there's great talent everywhere. And I get pushback from that, from my guys, because, oh, you know, we want someone in our time zone, or, you know, these people, the communication. But it's like, I'm like, keep looking, because they're out there. I know they're out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to bring up that America was the land of opportunity. And what is that opportunity that we're talking about? It's not the opportunity to go to the doctor easily, right? It's the land of economic opportunity. That's really what that is. The future land of opportunity is the internet. The internet is the land of economic opportunity. And as more things move online, we have an online culture, right? Like, people in any country know Taylor Swift memes. It's like, what is your main skill that you're providing? If it's that you're close to me and you speak English, it's like, dude, the bar has been raised so much. And like, that's unfortunately what I think a lot of college grads are coming out of a system that they have $100,000 in student loans. And they're like, yeah, I live in your city and I speak English. And it's like, yeah, dude, I mean, that's an Uber driver. Like, so.
For a long time, if you were born in America, it was going to go pretty well for you. And that's, I don't think, necessarily a given over the next 50 years. And I don't think people have caught up to it. There's an interesting idea that when you look backwards, disruption is so easy to see. One of my favorite stories of this is Research in Motion. Research in Motion made BlackBerry phones. And in 2006 or 2007, whenever Apple released the iPhone, I think there was this initial kind of unease at BlackBerry, at Research in Motion, about what this meant. But then you know what happened in the quarter after the iPhone was released? They hit the highest profits they'd ever hit. And you know what happened the quarter after that? They hit the highest profits they'd ever hit. And if you look at their stock price, the iPhone hits and the stock price keeps going and the profits keep going. But what we all know is that they were a dead man walking, that it was basically up for them and they just hadn't had the shock happen yet. And so I do wonder about that. Like, obviously we're in a period where, like you said, Sean, the internet and technology is disrupting everything. And yet I get the sense sometimes, and this is maybe part of what inspired this tweet, I get the sense sometimes that some of the very people that are being disrupted, I don't know if it's that they don't want it to be true or they just haven't like kind of played things out yet. They don't realize that they're in the process of being disrupted. Like you said, Sean, if you're enjoying a salary or a job primarily because of geography or because of your language, like, that's a red flag right now. You should be concerned because those things are going to be, you know, totally erased by the internet over time. So that's kind of the stage we're in, is that there's a lot of disruption happening and some people aren't really aware of it. And like you said, we've got people coming out of college that have, you know, six-figure debt loads. The idea that of course I'm going to be able to find a job and of course it's going to work because that's just how the system works. And I just don't know that that's true anymore.
It's interesting. Like, I don't know about you guys, but the last 10, 20 years of my career, I've always heard that the internet is the great equalizer. Like, it's the greatest democratizing force in history. The thing that struck me with your tweet, Mike, was like, is this idea that I don't know that in North America, we've considered that this concept of democratization is a global force. Like, I think that's our own bravado, is that it's like, oh, remote work in America.
Well, I think we're just a little bit arrogant. And, you know, like, right. There's a great Barry Switzer quote that some people, you know, get born on third base and spend their life thinking they hit a triple. And it's like, there's a lot of the success that's come to Americans has not been that you're just that smart compared to the guy in Bangladesh. It's that you just were situated in a way where you had a bunch of built-in advantages. There's smart people all over the world. I mean, here's something that's undeniably true. The work ethic that exists in some countries is remarkable. And that, you know, there is quite a bit of entitlement that seeped into American culture.
Sean, do you see that with your team being so diverse and so remote?
Do I see
like the work ethic is different around the world? Like, because you've got American employees, you have people everywhere. Like, you're the most spread out, I think, of everybody on this call.
Yeah, look, I'll say different cultures are better at different things, right? Like, most of our project managers are in Latin America, and they're women, and they just run a tight fucking ship. So, like, they are, I mean, we don't set out to hire these people, but, and like, we have HR managers who are in Eastern Europe, and they are as ruthless as you think they are. So I don't know. I don't know what, like, it's just, I think different cultures are better at different things. What I'll say is, if we're thinking about globalization, you should think about whatever that, I forget the name of the rule, but like, it's the square root of the number of employees does 80% of the work or whatever.
Yeah.
And that applies globally to all citizens. So it's like, most of the best impactful work will be done by a very small number of people. And it's the same if they're in the Philippines, we're just giving them more opportunity. It's the same if they're in India, we're just giving them more opportunity to reach their full potential. So undoubtedly, the square root rule is that 95% of people actually are just cogs in a machine. If they're in the US or if they're in different countries, the 5% that can make a difference, now you can just reach them. And it's not even about salary expectations. It's about value delivered for those salaries. Because if you want someone to push buttons for minimum wage in America, you can hire that person, or you could hire that person in the Philippines, and it's basically the same fucking price. Like, I went to visit factories in China, and they're like, yeah, we pay people $10 an hour. It's like, yeah, it's basically what a factory in fucking Detroit would pay somebody. It's the same. But the big shift there is, like, I have a SEM manager and I pay him $90,000 a year, and he lives somewhere in Europe, and he's like the highest fucking paid person in his town, but he's just that good at SEM, right? So it's really finding those outliers no matter where they are. And I have people in Virginia, and I have people in fucking where, someplace I don't even know.
So to just make a point here that I think is pretty critical, if you are elite, we'll say top 1-5%, the internet is just unequivocally good for you. It just increases your opportunities and increases your reach, whether you're in America or you're in, whatever, Zimbabwe. Like, your life is going to be better because your excellence is just going to be seen by more people, and you're going to have more opportunities as a result. I think the point that's worth making is, if you are not elite, that it is, the internet is a downward force on your opportunities, and you need to think about how to either become elite at something, or if you're in your honest assessment, you're not, you need to figure out, how do I really maximize the competitive advantages that I do have, because otherwise it's going to be a painful coming 20 years.
Okay, so shout out to Sendlane, who's one of our sponsors, the pod. Just the team over there is incredible. What we want to hit on today, while I'm talking about Sendlane, because this is actually kind of cool, is Sendlane is actually going to make migration a little easier for you. Migrating email platforms, SMS platforms, is a giant pain in the ass. So what Sendlane is doing is, they are saying that we will not start billing you until you actually start sending email, SMS. So they want you warmed up. They want you making money before they charge you. That's a pretty incredible offer when you think about it. The team over there's support is legendary. Everybody in the industry kind of knows that at this point. So if you haven't checked out Sendlane, please go do so.
I want to tie Jason into this with something that's going to trigger him. You know, let's talk about this word equality, right? So it's like, so why should you in America be paid five times what somebody in, you know, Africa gets paid because you live here? Is that an equality system? Does equality only apply to people within your borders? How come it doesn't apply globally? Jason, what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, God.
Well, This is all nonsense. I mean, it's a market economy. This is, it's supply and demand. Life is ruled by supply and demand. You know, that's, that governs everything. At least it should, unless the government is interfering with it. So there's a demand for U.S. employees, and there's a demand for a type of employee that you can find outside the U.S. And so that's why the price, the cost is different. I mean, the cost should be different. It's just like, let's not forget about like basic economics here.
Well, this idea, I'll rant. The idea of equity, you're basically what you're doing, Sean. Equity is a big buzzword in our culture. It's just kind of a farcical idea. Equity doesn't exist, right? Even if you did somehow get equity within your state, you don't have it in your country. If you had it within your country, you don't have it between countries. Like, equity is a unicorn of an idea that people use to try and institute social change that's advantageous for them. Full stop. The to go a step further, I've seen a lot of economic work done on this. You know what economic progress and growing the pie does? It increases inequity, but everybody does better. The times that you get more equity in a culture is when things suck and where things aren't going well. When the economy is going well and wealth is being created and the pie is growing, it naturally produces inequity. And that's a good thing because everybody does better. And part of the reason for that is exactly what we're talking about, that like there are exceptional people that drive a lot of value and it helps everybody. It helps society to do better. This is like the whole idea behind capitalism. And we're just living in an age where capitalism is under assault, but it has been such a tremendous force for good. And this idea, like, we got to give up on this idea of equity. That's not to say that we don't want everybody to do better. It's that I do want everybody to do better, not just in my state or in my country, but like globally. And the only way to do that is if you're helping people that are outstanding in what they do, create value, grow the pie, and that is going to lead to more inequity. And all of these government ideas of like, oh, if we just taxed like the most wealthy people down to the level of other people, like every kind of process that we try to pull people together actually works against the real goal, which is making life better for everybody.
Governor Mike.
Yeah.
Well said,
yeah.
Governor Mike.
Yeah. I just, it was, it's a legitimate question about like, yeah, you know, where does equity stop in this equation? Like, if you have a global workforce, it's like, how come it's fair and okay to pay them way less, right? You end up going towards this global minimum wage. And I guess the other thing to add in there is, these are the same people who like traveling abroad because they're like, it's so much cheaper other places. I'm like, you're just pretending you're a rich person there. You're doing what rich people do in your own country when you go to fucking Brazil and you're like, dude, it's awesome here. It's so fucking cheap. It's like, it's not because that country's better. It's just because you're now the fucking rich person. So anyway, end rant. Matt, what else you got?
I think, Sean, the one thing you said that I think is important. So there's like two views. There's two ways to look at this, right? There's the operator, I run the business. Then there is the, I'm an employee of the business. So my view of this is there are only certain types of roles in your company where you should be looking for the very, 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 very like best, those outlier people. The vast majority of roles in a business do not need to be outlier people. Like, that's just true. If your company is full of superstars, you probably took too long to do it. And I'd be shocked. Like, none of us have a company full of superstars. That's just fucking true. So part of this is like, as operators, you got to identify like, what are the highest leverage, highest value roles? And then you go try to find and pay, just get the very best, regardless of where they are. I think the other side of that is also, as an operator, every other function in the business, if it is not one of those extreme leverage positions, you should be looking for what, Sean, I think your words were like, the most value for the dollar. And I think that's where Mike's tweet kind of struck a nerve for me, because I'm like, I mean, we've all got friends that do this. It is shocking to me the talent that's available around the world now. And I sort of like, I think that Mike, your tweet was a bit triggering for me, because like, I'm new to this. Like, why do I consistently insist that like, all of my hires have to be here? This is stupid. That is just like, it's actually, I'm considering now, it's like just bad business.
Okay, so like, let me turn it around and just make the exact, make a counterpoint. I actually think the very best companies are gonna say, I don't freaking care. I don't care how much I pay for people. Like, okay, so think about it this way. When you are talking about how do you build wealth, do you build wealth by cutting out your Starbucks every day? No, that's a stupid idea. Like that's the opiate for the masses of like, if you just cut your spending by $7 a day, you'll get there. It's like, no, the way that you build wealth is by owning assets and building equity. That's how you build wealth. So the same way, how do you build a great company? Do you do it by paying 15 or 30% less on overhead? No, you don't. You do it by creating something that is in really high demand with awesome distribution where you can charge a premium price. And so I guess here's my even counter idea to my tweet. I think the very best companies are going to say, I'll hire whoever I want. And I'm going to optimize for making the best dang product. And I don't care if I overpay or underpay. I'm not even thinking about that. Whereas I think weaker companies are going to use outsourcing as a way to cut costs and try and be incrementally more profitable. And that's fine, but that's not how you build significant wealth. So like it's interesting, Netflix in their culture doc, they make this observation that in process related jobs, that the best workers, like, so if you think in assembly line, the best workers end up being 2, 3, 4 times better than the worst, right? So there's a gap, but it's like, you can only put widgets on so quickly, no matter how good you are. But in creative endeavors, the best workers are 100 times or 1,000 times more valuable. And so that would be my view, is that some of what we do is actually creative in nature. It's not just punching in keys or entering data in cells. It's actually creative. And that's actually where relationships and working close to people and the kind of community that you build with your team really matters. So here's my kind of assertion. The very best teams are going to be teams that optimize for that, because they realize that just making the best product possible is what matters. Weak teams are going to be characterized by trying to cut costs, by trying to outsource labor.
I think that's what I'm saying, Mike, is that in every company, there is a there's some amount of the team that is those people. Mm-hmm. And then there is some amount of the team that is more process driven work.
Yeah.
And that might make sense, in most physical products businesses, it's hard to argue that doesn't exist. Like, we have factories that make things, right?
Although it's very much an assembly line. We haven't talked about it, but the big question is, how much does AI just make that obsolete? Like the button pushers, like that may just go away.
That's the key. Yeah, that's the key.
So I think most companies operate like the Cavaliers when LeBron James is there. It's just get LeBron the ball. That's the process, right? And that is support staff, making sure superstars can do what they have to do. But I do think we're having the wrong conversation. This isn't about cheap outsourced labor. In 2 years, all of those jobs will be done by AI, right? And then it's like, what happens when the global workforce, the demand for what 70% of people do is reduced? It's like you have automated factories in China, you have automated factories in Mexico, and you have AI doing all your fucking data entry. So like, what does that workforce look like? If you're a college student to now, what the fuck do you do?
Yeah, on that note, this is something most people don't realize. If you look at robotics and who's buying robotics, the number one buyer of robotics by like, they're bigger than everybody else. They're more than double the next closest country, or a third, three times bigger than the next closest country is China. Like, so people associate China with low cost labor, but they're the ones buying all the robotics and leaning into it super heavy right now.
Well, they're also going to have a labor problem too with the shrinking of their population. But this whole point about AI, so let's talk about AI for a minute. And I'm not spending a lot of time thinking about AI. I'll leave it to the kiddos. But in reality, this is just an advancement of humanity. It's just the way it is, like it or hate it. But just like there aren't carriage drivers or buggy whip salesmen anymore, like this just happens, right? And it's the same as we said about like going to the office. You need to make yourself indispensable, even though everyone is replaceable at the end of the day. Like, you need to make yourself as indispensable as possible. And you need to be thinking, forward thinking about your future and your place and your ability to compete on the world stage, your ability to compete in a global economy. And like dyeing your hair blue and getting a bunch of earrings and tattoos, which, by the way, I think tattoos are great. I've got a couple, but like that ain't gonna do it for you unless you're really, really freaking special, like really special at something, in which case, like, then you can kind of look wherever you want because you're just so over the top. get great at something, but like, I just feel like there's so many people that they are so, their life is too easy and they're able to do what you're seeing on college campuses and everything else. Like their life is just too easy. And you know what? In 10 years, 15 years, or even less, like those people, a lot of those people are going to be in a world of hurt. And there's only so many Starbucks baristas that you're going to need in the United States.
Mike, you've got young kids, to what Jason's saying, because Jason, your kids are older, right? Like your kids
22
are
22 and 20.
And yeah. they went to college.
One graduated and is working, and one is at a very expensive private school. Yes.
Okay. Mike, your kids are younger. My daughter's going to be turning 9. Sean, I know kids are at least on the brain. What are you going to advise your children to do? Like, what are you coaching them towards, leading them towards?
A couple things that I see that I think are interesting. One is that a lot of schools, what they're doing, especially public schools, they're really integrating a lot of like iPads and laptops. And the idea is, well, the future is technology. So we have to teach our kids, you know, from when they're sixth grade, seventh grade, we got to teach them how to use technology, how to use Excel, how to use Word, how to be online. And my take is actually that's not very helpful, because the technology is moving so quick that the idea that the way that I prepare my kids for the future is by making them better than Excel. Like, I don't even know that people are going to be using Excel 10 or 15 years from now, certainly not the way that they have been. And so I actually think that, interestingly enough, classical education and teaching children logic, rhetoric, like understanding how to think through problems from a first principles perspective is actually more important than ever before. At a time when our school system does less of that than ever before, like they don't teach things like, you know, personal financial planning, they don't teach kids how to start a business, they don't, and that those things are actually really critically in need. And then the second thing I would say is, I'm going to teach my kids to own things, because if you're depending on someone else to provide you a job, then you are just kind of captive to the trends and the environment. And if you own something, then you have agency. And so I do think that for anybody listening to this podcast, and obviously we're talking to people who are operators, like the number one way that you can maintain agency in a period of incredible uncertainty, which is what is ahead of us, is by having equity and owning something, because then no matter how the technology changes or how things shift, you're going to have the ability to make choices and not have those choices made for you. So those are the two big things I'm focusing on with my kids.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to the Operator's North Beam ad unit. So 30 seconds, I'm going to tell you all about how, if you have any problems with North Beam, you can directly message Austin, the CEO. He is there. He will set up your ad account. He will make your bet. He'll give you cookies. Really, they have a dedicated team of people, probably 30, 40, 50 reps at this point, who will make sure North Beam is working correctly and functioning so you can get amazing data out of this ecosystem. They will be more hands-on than any Meta rep will ever be, and they're going to help you understand where your ad dollars are best spent, best positioned, and which ads are working. My team works with the North Beam team literally every day. They're in my Slack. Maybe you don't get the same level of support as an operator, but they will be there to make sure it's working. And if you're not happy at all, just email Austin. He will take care of you. We use North Beam every day. It's a benchmarking tool. It's super helpful for forecasting, daily pacing, inter-hour pacing. So we can see, like, if we just launched an ad in 2 hours, if it's working or not. That's what North Beam does for us. So thank you, North Beam, for the support. I'm customer probably number one. So thank you so much.
Well, one thing to add regarding North Beam, because we just went through a contract renewal with them on their specifically on the MMM. And we got a pretty sweetheart deal, and I expect them to come back to us and raise our price, and they kind of deserve it. I was like, let me reach out to the team, you know, and see how it's going, right? Because I'm not in the day-to-day. I get feedback. And the team was like, they have improved the MMM so much since we started it that they were like, we should definitely pay for this increase. So, and my team hates every agency and most SaaS. The only person that hates SaaS, the only more than my team is Sean Frank. But yeah, I mean, they came to us. They're like, hey, you guys got the sweetheart deal. We're one of the first MMM clients. And I was very, very pleased when my team was like, it's really working well for us. So that's my little MMM plug.
Well, I think that this is like an easy one to transition to just like this. And I think, Jason, you already hit on this when you were talking about the media buying. Like, there's certain functions where like freelancing is obviously very prevalent. But are we entering a world where like it's the freelancification of everything? Like, well, like in 10 years, is there a non-zero chance that we have no employees and that we just have like an army of freelancers?
You're talking about the gig economy of knowledge work.
Like, yeah. Like, is that where this goes? Do we just gig everything?
Totally. I mean, Upwork started that. And it's like, the other thing is in the US, it is incredibly hard and expensive to have W-2 employees. And like, if I'm the first person telling everybody that, then like, I can't believe it. It's fucking shocking. It is way cheaper and easier to use contractors for everything.
Why is that? Could you just educate me on that? I'm sure there's people who are listening that don't know what the hell that is.
I think I have like 90 W-2 employees. I pay 6% 401k match. So their salary is already 6% higher. I pay for all of their benefits. So that is on average $600 a month to pay for these people's benefits. I pay for any of their time off. Okay. I pay for their computers. I pay for any of these issues that come up. So if I have a $100,000 a year W-2 employee, they probably, because of payroll taxes and everything, make $85,000 and it costs me $135,000. Now, if I give $100,000 to a contractor, they get $100,000. They deal with all their fucking taxes. They deal with their benefits. So the cost to have a W-2 employee is just way, way, way higher. So it's already fucking hard to hire these people. So,
and you can let go of a contractor a lot easier than an employee.
Yeah, this isn't even with, you know, if I fire somebody, I give them 3 months severance, like all this fucking paperwork and stuff to have W-2 employees. So America is not doing any favors to W-2 employees. It makes it difficult to hire them. And to tie it back to the previous point, you know, Mike's tweet is that he thinks employees are going to demand in-person work because it'll protect their jobs. If you've seen anything from unions, they will act against their interests, okay? They will demand things that put companies into bankruptcy. We saw this with Yellow, like the transit people. They had a benefits package that Yellow's like, we can't pay this, we're gonna go bankrupt. And that's what they struck for, and now they're bankrupt. So I don't think that's going to happen. I don't know what the future looks like, but it's probably more freelancification for U.S. labor.
Well, I'll tell you who has an extreme interest in a bunch of these jobs not being outsourced also: the United States government.
Yeah.
Right? Like, here's one kind of like the second and third order effects of this are going to be super interesting. And that's more that what I was trying to do with that tweet is make people think through second and third order effects. Because listen, if you start outsourcing a bunch of your labor, if you start doing it, you know, gig economy people, and that it's up to them to pay their taxes, guess what's going to happen to revenues at the federal level? They're going to go down. And how's the government going to respond to that? They're going to punch back. They're going to incentivize or force people to have W-2 employees. This thing is just getting started. And if you're a business owner, you should anticipate not yet. Like, yeah, businesses are going to try and gravitate towards the smartest people and the cheapest people. And that is not going to be in the interest of American workers or the American government. And they are going to respond. And it's going to get interesting.
I know, because government sponsors always do a great job. I don't know. That's where I think you lost me. Look, the government may try to respond. It won't work. And at the end of the day, it's the market will win out. And this is just the direction we're going. And I go back to my previous statement that you as an individual need to always be thinking about how you remain competitive until you no longer have to. I think about it for me. How do I remain competitive in the world to continue to live the way I want to live until I have enough that I don't have to care anymore?
So let me make my really simple argument here, Jason. The internet is generally great for the top 5%, and it's a total power law. It accrues benefits to the top 1% to 5% really disproportionately. So in a democratic society where it's, you know, rule by majority, the internet is going to gradually, that aspect of the internet is going to become gradually and gradually less popular. Now, I think it's possible that what that means is the kind of creator class in the internet gravitate somewhere other than the US, which would be too bad for the US. I could see the US passing policy that basically encourages that group to leave. I mean, I don't know. I read Atlas Shrugged a year ago and it was like, man, it's not impossible to imagine a world like this where the creator class just kind of says, you know, we're done with it in America or in a country because there's better opportunity somewhere else. I'm just saying if a bunch of people are losing their job to outsourcing, it is going to become their number one voting issue. We know this. What do people vote on? The economy is always number one. Jobs is always number one. And so if there's a bunch of outsourcing or if there's a bunch of them feeling like they're getting replaced by AI, that's going to be what they're going to vote on. And you're going to see policy based on that. Not Mike, saying it'll be smart policy, just saying that's what probably will happen.
Yeah.
Mike just got back from Washington. He's got so much faith in the American system.
Well, no, you've already
I've got
seen...
faith in people being voting in their economic interests. I have faith in that.
That's an assumption that people are actually rational in their own.
It's true.
But you've already seen people in the UK leave to Dubai to get around paying taxes, right? And the US is one of the only countries on earth where your citizenship is a burden. When it comes to taxes, no matter where you live, you file and pay.
That blows me away.
Well, Matt, it's coming to Canada. Justin Trudeau has a leaked memo where he is trying to make the Canadian Citizenship Act like the US. So
yeah.
If you live somewhere else, you're going to be paying the Canadian taxes, right?
Yeah. Well, my Italian passport will come in real handy when that
So
happens.
Funny tweet I saw on this.
Yeah.
Apparently there is a bridge right by the New Jersey, New York border, where if you go there any given night, you will see cars waiting to go into New York at 12:01 a.m. You guys know why? Because you have to be in New York less than a certain number of days year, or you get taxed as a New York resident.
It's like 6%, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So people will literally, to the minute, they will figure it out. Okay, I can be here whatever it is, 150 days. I'm going to be here 149 days, 23 hours, you know, and I'm going to time it down to that. And they'll just hang out in their limos right at the border and time it to make sure that they're getting it just right. This is the thing about all like the billionaire taxes that's just so funny. Like these countries think, oh, we're going to tax billionaires out the wazoo. Like you're talking about the most enabled, resource-laden class of people in the world. They're just going to dodge it, right? It doesn't work. It's not effective. There's a lot of research about this. These countries, these European countries that have passed these really high taxes on people with extremely high net worths. And not surprisingly, those people just go away. They just go get citizenship somewhere else or they find a way around the tax.
So
can I ask you guys, I want to ask you guys a question as operators, because I know we're coming up on time. If you were starting your companies today, like knowing what you know now, would the way that you staff your businesses be different from how you currently are? Maybe let's just go around like Sean, Mike, Jason.
No, okay. I just want to say the power law thing. In California, the top 1,000 families pay 50% of the taxes. In New York City, the top 100 people pay 50% of the taxes. So it is really the top of the top. Would I change how I staff my business? No, I love how I staff my business. It's perfect. I hire and fire exactly who I want, no matter where they are. It breaks down that 90% of my payroll goes to US people because they have the skills that I value right now, right? We have shifted our business to try to get the very best people to do the jobs that we do. And it leads to a lot of weird economic outcomes, but pass the buck over to Jason.
Man, you're hitting a sore subject right now because like at our size, like my job is becoming like literally just about being a psychotherapist for employees. So I kind of want to like, you know, reduce the headcount at Hexpat by like 50%, even though I like love everybody. It's just a lot. You know, it's just so much. Like I would figure out how to do it smaller for sure. And I think it's becoming the government and society and like, it's making it harder to run your business because the people issues become, as when you reach a certain level, it becomes really all about people issues. That's what I'm seeing now. And so I don't want to get off on a tangent here. And so I'm going to stop this. But like, when your business gets as big as ours, it's amazing how much it becomes about people issues.
Mike, what about you, man?
I think the most important thing when you're running a business is understanding what you're optimizing for. Sean said it earlier, and I just really want to emphasize the point that he made, which is there's trade-offs. Very rarely are things just better or worse. They're just different. And part of being a smart, intelligent leader is being able to identify how they're different and what the trade-offs are. For me, one of the things that I realized, this goes all the way back to the founding of Simple Modern, was I'm going to be spending 40, 50, 60 hours a week working. So if you think about it, like how many hours are you even awake in a week? You know, like, okay, you're awake, whatever, 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. So you're awake 102 hours. What that means is that about half of my waking hours for as long as I work with the company are going to be working. So what I realized was the quality of life that I have when I'm working is a huge piece of how I want to staff. That actually matters to me a lot. That if you said, hey, Mike, you can make $10 million and have bad quality of life for those 50 hours, but you make $10 million, or you can make $5 million and have much better quality of life, then I would take that trade. Because, you know, what we end up doing is we end up taking our money and trying to turn it into quality of life. So I built our entire staffing around two things. How do I build a really successful company? And how do I maximize my quality of life while I'm working? And like, not saying it's better, not saying it's worse, just saying I was intentional about that. And so if that means that I end up paying more money in overhead than I would have doing it a different way, I'm fine with that. Honestly, I'm great with it, because what I'm really in this for is to maximize my quality of life and to feel like I'm making an impact. And I feel like I'm doing that. And so I think as a business owner, it just starts with understanding what are you maximizing for? What are the trade-offs? And it helped me a ton that I had a really clear picture of that at the start.
I got to jump in a couple minutes. All I want to say is I think the future looks more like populism. I think we have to make sure America and Canada is a great place to build a business. And we have to make sure that it's a great place to have workers. And I think it's going to have to be a great place to be a worker. The current policies we're rolling out don't allow for that. I think we're going to have a lot of angry, dejected college graduates over the next 24 months. And they seem to realize that, like, the enemy isn't international workers. The enemy is AI, and it's going to replace so many of these entry-level jobs. I pay a lot of money for high-level people who are skilled. You got to vote for people like Mike. You got to vote for people like me who will take over Mexico and Canada so that we can have a stronghold in North America. Thank you. Goodbye.
We didn't talk about the college thing. I know Sean has to go, but I think I can hit it in like a minute.
Yeah. Let's do it. You Sean, know, like, get out of here, man.
In the show notes, we were talking about does it make sense to go to send kids to college these days? And I actually wanted to ask Sean this, but he's gone. I don't think Sean actually graduated college, did he? I recall.
I don't think so. I know I didn't. Like, I didn't. Yeah.
Well, there you go. And this is coming from someone who has 3 degrees. Like, I don't think college is a necessity anymore. I've hired like 1,000 people over my career or more. And I was always very cognizant of their educational background and where they went to school. And I no longer am. Like, there's a guy on our growth team. He's like 23, 24 years old, never went to college. He started working in e-com like when he was in high school, and is incredibly productive, great team member, never went to school. And he is earning a very good living at 23, 24 years old, more than most people I know. I mean, he's earning more than my son, who graduated UMiami, a good, expensive private school, who's got a good job working for a good agency, right? So I think that we're going to see a real shift away from having to spend incredible amounts of money on a college education. I think there are some, it's going to take time. Because there are some families like my family, which was like, you know, you're going to go to a 4-year school, you're going to get that college education. But let this be like, but let me make this clear. I've spent probably $500,000 on my two children's college education.
Wow.
And I did it because I wanted them to have that life experience of going to college. But I think the way the world is changing, there's other ways to get that life experience. So I wanted them to have that experience. I think it was a great experience for both of them. It's made them better people, or more well-rounded people, but it's not completely necessary like it used to be. I don't even look at where people went to school when I get their resumes now. And I went to a Ivy League business school, you know, and a top 20 law school. I don't even look anymore.
Yeah, I think most companies now, most tech companies don't look. I know, I think I posted the stats, like 14.5% of postings even mention a college degree now, like a bachelor's degree. So like, I really don't think that's where the world is going. I do think you hit on an important point though, Jason, which is like in my network, my friends that have kids who are about to go to college, the conversation is actually more around like, do they want this experience? It's not actually optimizing to an economic outcome. But they're not like, you should go here to get a better job. It's, if you want to go to have fun, knock yourself out. But it is actually, there's no like competitive advantage now as an individual going to post-secondary. I mean, there's clearly there are certain jobs where that is not true. Like, you know, if you want to be a doctor, a medical doctor, you probably have to go to school to do that.
Law school too, right?
But yeah, sure.
I will say this, like undergrad, if you're like one of these people that, you know, I was just going to go get a college education and then I'm going to go on with my life, it's really not necessary. Business school, like I went to business school because there were things that I really wanted to learn and that was like the way to do it. I mean, there were probably other paths to do it, but I really, really, really enjoyed going to business school because I wanted to get like my hands dirty with accounting and finance in a way that I wasn't able to do because I went to law school and I wasn't a business undergrad guy. I was like a poli sci, you know, want to be a lawyer undergrad guy. So I found that incredibly, incredibly useful. Going to business school was incredibly useful. But there's ways around it now.
Yep.
So, okay. So I've got a take on this and then we can wrap this up. One of the things that college does is it's a credentialing process, right? And what we're really saying here is that the way that the world works when it comes to credentialing and the way that it thinks about credentialing has changed. So, for example, we are living in an age where in certain situations, the fact that I have 40,000 Twitter followers is a better credential than me having a university diploma, which is kind of sounds weird to say, but like in some context, that's actually true. And I think the interesting question here is, how does credentialing change going forward? Because people are always going to care about credentials. Like that's not going away. The internet didn't disrupt that. It just moved around what credentials they look at and why they look at them. And so it's an interesting question of like, what are you trying to accomplish? And what are going to be the credentials that matter when it comes to accomplishing that thing? Because it's still a case, like if you're a doctor, I don't care how many Twitter followers you have. I care where you went to medical school, right? Like that still matters. And I don't know that the internet will ever disrupt that. But then there's other areas where it's like, you know, I don't care where you went to business school. I care a lot more about what have you done in your career so far? What businesses have you worked on? What have you done? So anyway, it's an interesting question for everybody of like, what are you trying to do and how do credentials matter? And what are the types of credentials that matter? And then one other thing I'll say, I'm still pretty involved with my university. I do some things with them and help them when it comes to recruiting and different things. But they had me speak at this recruitment event not too long ago. And I'm talking to a bunch of prospective students. And I don't know that the university knew I was going to say this when they invited me. They probably wouldn't have invited me if they'd known. But I basically got up there and said, like, listen, it used to be that the university was this gatekeeper, that the only way that you could get to knowledge was by going to school. Like they had all the knowledge and the professors and the libraries, and you really literally could not learn the things if you didn't go there. Well, that day is over. The internet has totally disrupted that. The internet is full of all the information that you would get if you came to university. Like you can go and take MIT classes for free or watch them on YouTube or whatever. My assertion is the other than credentialing and relationships, which you mentioned, Jason, and I think those are a big deal. The relational development piece matters. But the thing that you can get from school in general, whether this is a college degree or anything else, is we're entering a period of human history where the most important skill is that you love learning. Full stop. That there's so much information available that if you have the judgment and discernment to know what information is worth learning and that you really love learning, then you're going to be successful. It's almost a given that you're going to be successful. But what?
Right. That's awesome.
But that, most people don't ever learn that, right?
Yep.
That is gold.
Man. 100%. That's so good.
Let's end it on that, boys.
Is that the pod?
That's the pod.
All right, guys, thanks for joining us. Some really good thoughts this week. Want to thank our sponsors once again, Fulfill, North Beam, and Synlane. Thanks for making this podcast possible. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll see you next time.